This is cassette number 8.
How long have you been a ranger? Reacher asked.
17 years.
How much do you know about the Border Patrol?
Enough, I guess.
You prepared to give me a straight yes-no answer? No comebacks?
What's the question?
You recall the Border Patrol investigation 12 years ago?
Maybe.
Was it a whitewash? Rodriguez paused a long moment, and then he answered with a single word. I'll call you back, Reacher said. He hung up and turned and spoke over his shoulder to Alice. You get Walker? He asked.
He's up to speed. He wants us to wait for him here for when he's through with the FBI.
Reacher shook his head. Can't wait here. Too obvious. We need to stay on the move. We'll go to him, and then we'll get back on the road. She paused a beat.
Are we in serious danger?
Nothing we can't handle. She said nothing. You worried?
He asked. A little. A lot, actually.
You can't be. I'm going to need your help.
Why was the lie about the ring different?
Because everything else is hearsay. But I found out for myself the ring wasn't a fake. Direct personal discovery, not hearsay, feels very different.
I don't see how it's important.
It's important because I've got a whole big theory going, and the lie about the ring screws it up like crazy.
Why do you want to believe her so much?
Because she had no money with her.
What's the big theory?
Remember that Balzac quotation and Marcuse? Alice nodded. I've got another one, Reacher said. Something Ben Franklin once wrote.
What are you, a walking encyclopedia?
I remember stuff I read, is all. And I remember something Bobby Greer said, too, about armadillos. She just looked at him.
You're crazy.
He nodded. It's only a theory. It needs to be tested. But we can do that.
How?
We just wait and see who comes for us. She said nothing. Let's go check in with Walker, he said. They walked through the heat to the courthouse building. There was a breeze again, blowing in from the south. It felt damp and urgent. Walker was on his own in his office, looking very tired. His desk was a mess of phone books and paper.
Well, it started. Biggest thing you ever saw. FBI and state police, roadblocks everywhere, helicopters in the air, more than 150 people on the ground. But there's a storm coming in which ain't going to help.
Reacher thinks they're holed up in a motel, Alice said.
Walker nodded grimly.
If they are, they'll find them. Manhunt like this, it's going to be pretty relentless.
You need us anymore? Reacher asked. Walker shook his head.
We should leave it to the professionals now. I'm going home, grab a couple hours rest.
Reacher looked around the office, the door, the floor, the windows, the desk, the filing cabinets.
I guess we'll do the same thing. We'll go to Alice's place. Call us if you need us, or if you get any news, okay?
Walker nodded.
I will. I promise.
We'll go as FBI again, the woman said. It's a no-brainer.
All of us? The driver asked. What about the kid?
The woman paused. She had to go because she was the shooter. And if she had to split the team 2-1, she wanted the tall guy with her, not the driver. You stay with the kid, she said. There was a moment's silence.
Abort the horizon?
The driver asked. It was their standard operating procedure. Whenever the team was split, the woman set an abort horizon, which meant that you waited until the time had passed, and then, if the team wasn't together again, you got the hell out, every man for himself.
4 hours, okay?
The woman said.
Done and dusted.
She stared at him a second longer, eyebrows raised, to make sure he understood the implication of her point. Then she knelt and unzipped the heavy valise.
So let's do it, she said.
They did the exact same things they had done for Al Eugene, except they did them a whole lot faster because the Crown Vic was parked in the motel's lot, not hidden in a dusty turnout miles from anywhere. The lot was dimly lit and mostly empty, and there was nobody around, but it still wasn't a secure feeling. They pulled the wheel covers off and threw them in the trunk. They attached the communications antennas to the rear window and the trunk lid. They zipped blue jackets over their shirts. They loaded up with spare ammunition clips. They squared the souvenir ball caps on their heads. They checked the loads in their 9mm pistols and racked the slides and clicked the safety catches and jammed the guns in their pockets. The tall, fair man slipped into the driver's seat. The woman paused outside the motel room door.
4 hours,
she said again.
done and dusted.
The driver nodded and closed the door behind her, glanced over at the kid in the bed.
Done and dusted meant leave nothing at all behind, especially live witnesses.
Reacher took the heckler and crotch and the maps of Texas and the FedEx packet out of the VW and carried them into Alice's house, straight through the living room and into the kitchen area. It was still and cool inside, and dry. The central air was running hard. He wondered for a second what her utility bills must be like. "Where's the scale?" he asked. She pushed past him and squatted down and opened the cupboard, used two hands and lifted a kitchen scale onto the countertop. It was a big piece of equipment. It was new, but it looked old. A retro design. It had a big, white, upright face, the size of a china plate, like the speedometer on an old-fashioned sedan. It was faced with a bulbous plastic window with a chromium bezel. There was a red pointer behind the window and large numbers around the circumference, a manufacturer's name, and a printed warning, not legal for trade. "Is it accurate?" he asked. Alice shrugged.
"I think so. The nut roast comes out okay."
There was a chromium bowl resting in a cradle above the dial. He tapped on it with his finger, and the pointer bounced up to a pound and then back down to zero. He took the magazine out of the heckler and koch and laid the empty gun in the bowl. It made a light metallic sound. The pointer spun up to 2 pounds and 6 ounces. Not an especially light weapon. About right, he figured. His memory told him the catalog weight was in the region of 43 ounces with an empty magazine. He put the gun back together and opened cupboards until he found a store of food. He lifted out an unopened bag of granulated sugar. It was in a gaudy yellow packet that said 5 pounds on the side.
"What are you doing?"
"Weighing things," he said. He stood the sugar upright in the chromium bowl. The pointer spun up to 5 pounds exactly. He put the sugar back in the cupboard and tried a cellophane-wrapped packet of chopped nuts. The pointer read 2 pounds. He looked at the label on the packet and saw 2 pounds. "Good enough," he said. He folded the maps and laid them across the top of the bowl. They weighed 1 pound and 3 ounces. He took them off and put the nuts back on. Still 2 pounds. He put the nuts back in the cupboard and tried the FedEx packet. It weighed 1 pound and 1 ounce. He added the maps, and the pointer inched up to 2 pounds 4 ounces. Added the loaded gun on top, and the pointer jerked around to 5 pounds 3 ounces. If he had wanted to, he could have calculated the weight of the bullets. "Okay, let's go," he said. "But we need gas, long ride ahead. And maybe you should get out of that dress. You got something more active?"
"I guess,"
she said, and headed for the stairs. "You got a screwdriver?" he called after her.
"Under the sink,"
she called back. He bent down and found a brightly colored toolbox in the cupboard. It was made out of plastic and looked like a lunch pail. He clicked it open and selected a medium-sized screwdriver with a clear yellow handle. A minute later, Alice came back down the stairs wearing baggy, khaki cargo pants and a black T-shirt with the sleeves torn off at the shoulder seams.
"Okay?"
she asked. "Me and Judith," he said. "Got a lot in common." She smiled and said nothing. "I'm assuming your car is insured. It could get damaged tonight." She said nothing, just locked up her door and followed him out to the VW. She drove out of her complex, with Reacher craning his neck, watching the shadows. She got gas at a neon-bright, all-night station out on the El Paso Road. Reacher paid for it. "Okay, back to the courthouse," he said. "Something I want from there." She said nothing, just turned the car and headed east, parked in the lot behind the building. They walked around and tried the street door. It was locked up tight.
"So what now?"
she asked. It was hot on the sidewalk, still up there around 90 degrees, and damp. The breeze had died again. There were clouds filling the sky. "I'm going to kick it in," he said.
"There's probably an alarm."
"There's definitely an alarm. I checked."
"So?"
"So I'm going to set it off."
"Then the cops will come?"
"I'm counting on it."
"You want to get us arrested?"
"They won't come right away. We've got 3 or 4 minutes, maybe." He took 2 paces back and launched forward and smashed the flat of his sole above the handle. The wood splintered and sagged open a half inch, but held. He kicked again, and the door crashed back and bounced off the corridor wall. A blue strobe high up outside started flashing, and an urgent electric bell started ringing. It was about as loud as he had expected. "Go get the car," he said. "Get it started and wait for me in the alley." He ran up the stairs, 2 at a time, and kicked in the outer office door without breaking stride, jinked through the secretarial pen like a running back, and steadied himself and kicked in Walker's door. It smashed back, and the Venetian blind jerked sideways, and the glass pane behind it shattered, and the shards rained down like ice in winter. He went straight for the bank of filing cabinets. The lights were off, and the office was hot and dark, and he had to peer close to read the labels. It was an odd filing system. It was arranged partly in date order and partly by the alphabet. That was going to be a minor problem. He found the cabinet marked B and jammed the tip of the screwdriver into the keyhole and hammered it in with the heel of his hand, turned it sharp and hard and broke the lock, pulled the drawer and raked through the files with his fingers. The files all had tiny labels encased in plastic tabs arranged so they made a neat diagonal from left to right. The labels were all typed with words starting with B, but the contents of the files were way too recent, nothing more than 4 years old. He stepped 2 paces sideways and skipped the next B drawer and went to the next but one. The air was hot and still, and the bell was ringing loud, and the glare of the flashing blue strobe pulsed in through the windows. It was just about keeping time with his heartbeat. He broke the lock and slid the drawer, checked the labels. No good. Everything was either 6 or 7 years old. He had been inside the building 2 minutes and 30 seconds. He could hear a distant siren under the noise of the bell. He stepped sideways again and attacked the next B drawer. He checked the dates on the tabs and walked his fingers backward. 2 minutes and 50 seconds. The bell seemed louder and the strobe seemed brighter. The siren was closer. He found what he was looking for 3/4 of the way back through the drawer. It was a 2-inch thick collection of paperwork in a heavy paper sling. He lifted the whole thing out and tucked it under his arm, left the drawer all the way open and kicked all the others shut, ran through the secretarial pen and down the stairs, checked the street from the lobby, and when he was certain it was clear, he ducked around into the alley and straight into the VW.
"Go,"
he said. He was a little breathless, and that surprised him.
"Where?"
"South, to the Red House."
"Why? What's there?"
"Everything." She took off fast, and 50 yards later, Reacher saw red lights pulsing in the distance behind them. The Pecos Police Department, arriving at the courthouse just a minute too late. He smiled in the dark and turned his head in time to catch a split-second glimpse of a big sedan nosing left 200 yards ahead of them into the road that led down to Alice's place. It flashed through the yellow wash of a streetlight and disappeared. It looked like a police-spec Crown Vic, plain steel wheels and 4 VHF antennas on the back. He stared into the darkness that had swallowed it and turned his head as they passed. "Fast as you can," he said to Alice. Then he laid the captured paperwork on his knees and reached up and clicked on the dome light so he could read it. The B was for Border Patrol, and the file summarized the crimes committed by it 12 years ago and the measures taken in response. It made for unpleasant reading. The border between Mexico and Texas was very long, and for an accumulated total of about half its length, there were roads and towns near enough on the American side to make it worth guarding pretty closely. Theory was, if illegals penetrated there, they could slip away into the interior fast and easily. Other sectors had nothing to offer except 50 or 100 miles of empty, parched desert. Those sectors weren't really guarded at all. Standard practice was to ignore the border itself and conduct random vehicle sweeps behind the line by day or night to pick the migrants up at some point during their hopeless 3 or 4 day trudge north across the wastelands. It was a practice that worked well. After the first 30 or so miles on foot through the heat, the migrants became pretty passive. Often they surrendered willingly. Often the vehicle sweeps turned into first aid mercy missions because the walkers were sick and dehydrated and exhausted because they had no food or water. They had no food or water because they had been cheated. Usually, they would pay their life savings to some operator on the Mexican side who was offering them a fully accompanied one-way trip to paradise. Vans and minibuses would take them from their villages to the border, and then the guide would crouch and point across a deserted footbridge to a distant sandhill and swear that more vans and minibuses were waiting behind it, full of supplies and ready to go. The migrants would take a deep breath and sprint across, only to find nothing behind the distant sandhill. Too hopeful and too afraid to turn back, they would just blindly walk ahead into exhaustion. Sometimes there would be a vehicle waiting, but its driver would demand a separate, substantial payment. The migrants had nothing left to offer, except maybe some small items of personal value. The new driver would laugh and call them worthless. Then he would take them anyway and offer to see what cash he could raise on them up ahead. He would drive off in a cloud of hot dust and never be seen again. The migrants would eventually realize they had been duped, and they would start stumbling north on foot. Then it became a simple question of endurance. The weather was key. In a hot summer, the mortality rate was very high. That was why the Border Patrol's random sweeps were often seen as mercy missions. Then, that suddenly changed.